I would think that $1.8 million to go to defend these attorneys who have engaged in intentional misconduct is just stunning.
Senator Murkowski questions the Attorney General over prosecutorial misconduct in the Ted Stevens case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, mushers reflect on Iditarod history.
Now we have this big hoopla and we complain when there's too much snow and we complain when there's too little snow and rah, 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 and those guys didn't even know they were going to have a trail. So I'm kind of looking at it that way.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Senator Lisa Murkowski today questioned Attorney General Eric Holder about money being spent to defend Justice Department prosecutors who are protesting the release of a report detailing mishandling of the prosecution of the late Senator Ted Stevens. One of those prosecutors has asked an appeals court for an emergency stay to prevent the release. Murkowski quizzed Holder before the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Commerce, Science, and Justice. She asked Holder if taxpayer money was being used to defend the prosecutors as they fight the public release of the report.
So the question is whether you support the merits of that appeal, and again, whether or not the taxpayers are on the hook to pay for his attorneys to argue that this report should be kept from the public.
Yeah, I don't think we take any position with regard to what he has said about his desire to keep the report sealed. But we, the Justice Department, has indicated that we do not object to the release of the report. I think that given the issues that we found there, the magnitude of the case, and frankly the magnitude of the errors that led me to decide to dismiss the case, that there is a legitimate public interest in knowing as much as we can about what happened, why it happened, what steps the Justice Department has taken in connection with these findings of misconduct.
Holder dismissed the conviction against Stevens because of the misconduct by prosecutors. Judge Emmett Sullivan, who presided over the Stevens trial, appointed an independent investigator to examine the case after it came to light that prosecutors had withheld evidence from Stevens' attorneys. The independent investigator found significant and intentional misconduct. The prosecutors asked Judge Sullivan to seal the report, but the judge said it's important for the public to know what happened. Following Holder's response, Murkowski pressed him about whether the Justice Department was paying for the prosecutor's challenge to releasing the report. Holder said it would have been a conflict of interest for the department to defend them,
which would be typically how we would do it, and they were therefore allowed to get outside counsel, and under the regulations, the Justice Department then pays for those legal representations, which has happened in a variety of cases, a variety of circumstances. Former attorneys general have been had lawyers who have been reimbursed by the government.
So even now that the independent counsel that Judge Sullivan had appointed, even though that counsel has found that members of the Stevens prosecution had engaged in significant, widespread, and at times intentional, and again, intentional misconduct, does the government have any recourse to recover the funds that have been paid for their attorney's fees?
Senator Murkowski said $1.8 million had been spent on their defense, calling the amount stunning. Murkowski added she was troubled the prosecutors were still employed at the Justice Department. Holder responded that because the prosecutors had their own views about what happened, they wanted to defend themselves, saying that was why the government hired outside counsel for them. Murkowski then thanked Subcommittee Chairwoman Barbara Mikulski for allowing her to take so much time. Mikulski, a Democrat from Maryland, responded the questioning was important and the issue troubling.
We must have public integrity. We also must have an independent judiciary. We have to have, regardless of which party is in the White House, a Justice Department that we believe in and that the American people believe in.
Texas Republican Kay Bailey Hutchinson had also questioned Holder. She said the Attorney General took a big step in dismissing the case.
That was huge. But now we must follow up so that there is no question that the people who did this, and the report will show whatever it shows, that they're not able to prosecute ever again, ever.
If the report is not held up by the appeal, it will be released next Wednesday, March 15th. The federal government is proposing at least $1 million reduction in funding for tsunami programs in Alaska. The agency in charge says the cuts are necessary and won't hurt the state's tsunami preparedness. But some scientists and officials disagree. They say the reduction in funding will weaken Alaska's tsunami programs and leave the state's coastal communities at risk. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, is proposing a $4.6 million reduction in funding for tsunami programs nationwide in the fiscal year 2013. Most of those savings will come at the expense of a program that gives money to states and academic institutions for tsunami outreach, education, and research. Roger Hansen is Alaska's state seismologist and director of the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, which is one of the organizations that receives funding through the program. He says it's a mistake for NOAA to pull the plug now, just 6 years after Congress passed the Tsunami Warning and Education Act, a law co-authored by the late Alaska Senator Ted Stevens that appropriated the initial funding.
It's imperative that we have this kind of funding continue, because you don't just put out a few signs and expect that solves your problem. It's an ongoing process of creating partnerships with the local communities, with the emergency managers, with the university that's doing the science arm of this kind of work.
But NOAA spokesperson Susan Buchanan says the program is no longer necessary.
That program has been a great success. It was sort of a ramping up. We needed to get the models in place. We needed to get the inundation maps in place. And we needed to do a lot of education and outreach. And since 2005, we've been very successful working with our partners at the state level to get coastal communities better prepared for tsunamis.
Hansen agrees that the program has been a success, but says that the modeling and inundation mapping are nowhere near done. In Alaska, more than 50 communities are still waiting to be mapped. And Hansen says the idea that a few years of training and education are enough is simply ludicrous.
To say that we've had a five-year program and everybody's safe now is very misleading. It's an ongoing process.
Hansen adds that cuts to outreach and education will have the greatest impact in states like Alaska and Oregon, where nearshore earthquakes pose the largest tsunami threat. He says for local events, there's no substitute for education and training, because there simply isn't enough time between the earthquake and the tsunami for NOAA's warning centers to issue an alert.
After the shaking stops, you probably have at most 10 minutes before the water starts to flood the city. In Seward, since there were landslides that were caused as an effect of the earthquake, it was about a minute and a half before the dock completely disappeared from the waterfront. So a minute and a half, and there's no way that a warning center can give out a warning to a community that all heck is going to break loose in a minute and a half.
Hansen also says the budget cuts will impact those centers' ability to issue warnings. He says while the U.S. Geological Survey operates most of the seismic stations used to generate warnings, the ones in the Aleutian Islands are operated by the Alaska Earthquake Information Center. That's his organization, the one that will lose some of its funding under the proposed cuts.
The fact that these are the only high-quality instruments, or near almost the only high-quality instruments in the Aleutians and in the Bering Islands, like St. Paul, makes them valuable, very invaluable to the tsunami warning centers. So those have to continue.
NOAA's Buchanan confirms that her agency's funding for that particular seismic network will disappear with the cuts. But she emphasized that tsunami warnings will continue to be generated and that federal education and outreach programs won't stop. The budget reduction is scheduled to take effect on October 1st, 2012. In Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Cleveland volcano has blown its top again. An explosion shook the restless Aleutian volcano at around 7 o'clock last night. There's no monitoring network on the volcano itself, but distant seismic stations and sound arrays picked up the blast. In a release, scientists at the Alaska Volcano Observatory said they suspect it was a small explosion, similar in size and magnitude to the one that happened in December. That eruption destroyed a lava dome that had been forming in Cleveland's crater for several months. Gases often collect underneath the domes, causing pressure to build until it explodes. A new dome had been forming in Cleveland's crater since the December event. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, rescuing a bear cub from a jar on top of a mountain.
I kind of thought for a second, well, I'll just pick him up, right? Pick him up and kind of just shake him out. And that still didn't do anything.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at AlaskaPublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
Jim Lanier was the first Iditarod musher to reach the Cripple checkpoint at just before 2 this afternoon. He has not yet taken his 24-hour layover, though, so Mitch Seavey, who arrived in Cripple 20 minutes later, is leading the race. Dallas Seavey is also in Cripple. According to GPS, John Baker, Lance Mackey, Jeff King, and Allie Zirkel are close behind. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, which is run on a trail that was first in use 100 years ago. APRN's Ann Hillman caught up with veteran mushers in Tocotna as they reflected on lessons learned in races past.
Dogs filled all of the parking spots in Tocotna this week as mushers slept, ate, and tended to their teams during their mandatory 24-hour rest period. One line of dogs began howling, then another continued the sound, singing a sort of sled dog round. Tocotna has been a popular 24-hour rest stop for years. Allie Zirkel's team was among the howlers. The dogs were eager to be running again. She says this year she spent much of her time on the trail reflecting on the race's history.
I think one of the neatest things for me right now is that I watched this special on the Iditarod, the 1973 Iditarod, the night before I left on the race, and I had just been kind of running the trail reminiscing about how those guys did it then and how neat it would be to do it then, and how when they started the race all their wives were standing at the starting line crying because they weren't sure whether they were going to see them again. And now we have this big hoopla, and we complain when there's too much snow, and we complain when there's too little snow, and rah, 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 and those guys didn't even know they were going to have a trail. So I'm kind of looking at it that way.
19-time Iditarod musher Mitch Seavey says racing style and strategy have changed since the early days as well.
And, you know, six-hour run, six-hour rest was pretty standard. Six on, six off. You were considered to be foolish if you didn't have an even run rest. I remember Susan Butcher almost chastising me once when I was first to some checkpoint. And she was right. I didn't belong being in front of the race at that point. I wasn't ready. But but nevertheless, you know, even run rest was the thing. Nowadays, it's way skewed, you know, less rest and more running. But there's a lot of things that feed into that, because we know a lot more about how to take care of a little sore wrist or sore shoulder or something that might come up, or foot care, nutrition. We've just perfected, or not perfected, but certainly improved our dog care and what we can then expect the dogs to do for us.
Five-time winner Rick Swenson says some of the younger mushers don't expect the dogs to do enough for them.
But I mean, I was traveling with a young guy a few years ago, and we got to a really steep, famous hill, and I rode up it. And I told him before we got there, I said, when we get to the top of Topcock Hill, I want to stop and snack the dogs. And he said, okay. And we got to the top, and it's a pretty steep hill. And it's a long one. We got to the top, and we could see the lights of Nome from up there and everything. And he said, now I know why you wear so many clothes. And I said, what do you mean? What? He says, you never got off. And I said, no, I didn't. If I would have got off, the dogs would have learned a bad lesson. He said, what do you mean? He said, they would have learned that they could expect me to get off to help them up the hill. That's their job, is to get me up the hill, themselves and me up the hill. I can't push them up the hill, you know. So then the next year I was traveling with that same guy, and we got to White Mountain Checkpoint, and he said, I'm going to be able to ride up that hill this year, I think. And I said, oh, yeah, really? And he says, yeah. He says, I've been working on that all year. My dogs, now when they see a hill, they know I'm going to stand on the back. I'm not going to get off and run. And I said, well, there you are. Now you're training the dogs instead of the dogs training you.
As the mushers head toward the halfway point at Cripple, they hope the years of training will pay off. In Takotna, I'm Ann Hillman.
A dispute over the revocation of a Wrangell physician's work at the city's hospital has finally resulted in ending the doctor's contract. The dust-up over Dr. Greg Szilard's work has been going back and forth between the Wrangell Medical Center board, who voted in November to revoke, and the physician for months. A Superior Court judge in December ordered Szilard's work rights be reinstated until a fair review hearing was conducted. That hearing concluded on February 21st. KSTK's Charlotte Duren has the details.
After the hearing, the committee had 20 days to file a decision on whether to grant a continued contract with WMC or to end the doctor's medical privileges at the hospital. On Friday, the WMC review hearing committee decided to end his contract. Hospital CEO Noel Sell-Ray says the review hearing committee's decision is consistent with its November decision.
They held or reaffirmed their decision that they made back in November, and that would conclude the appeal process under the MedStaff bylaws.
The hospital review hearing committee and Dr. Szilard are not disclosing the issues discussed at the meeting. However, Szilard said he's surprised by the committee's decision and plans to fight it.
Well, of course, I'm extremely disappointed. They made a decision based on very few incidents, none of which had anything to do with patient care. And what they've done is totally without precedent. I mean, a board does not deny privileges under conditions such as this.
Szilard is employed through Alaska Island Community Services, a nonprofit medical clinic. He started work as a physician in Wrangell in 2009 and was initially contracted to have hospital privileges through February of 2011. Last year, the WMC board granted Szilard a temporary contract extension to November of 2011. Now that the committee has denied Szilard a contract renewal, his attorney, Lee Holen, says they're working to get an injunction from the court to reinstate his privileges until the court has made a decision on the larger issues.
When we went to the judge earlier, he indicated he thought that Greg raised serious and substantial issues about whether or not he should have privileges. And so we'll intend to explore that with the court system. He has both grounds for appeal of this board decision as well as an independent whistleblower suit, because these issues were raised against him after he complained about the administration to the assembly.
At this time, Szilard is not authorized to work at the hospital. This infringes on his contract with AICS and ability to work with hospital and long-term care patients. He says if this is not reversed, AICS will no longer be able to keep him on as their physician. Medical Center Board Chairman Mark Robinson could not be reached for comment before this report's deadline. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Charlotte Duren.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick. So quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
A wildlife conservation professor says guns don't deter bear attacks as well as pepper spray. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Former Katmai National Park bear biologist Dr. Tom Smith, now of Brigham Young University in Utah, and the co-authors of a recent study analyzed 269 incidents in Alaska involving guns, people, and bears, most of them grizzly or brown bears. He says in 15% of those incidents, people panicked, decided they didn't want to shoot, couldn't get off a shot soon enough, or didn't hit the bear. He says 85% of the time, people did shoot the bear. In those 229 incidents, 175 bears were killed, but Smith says the people didn't fare so well either.
We had a 24% injury rate on humans. So, and of those injuries, there were some minor ones that didn't require hospitalization, but there were 17 fatalities where the bear did kill the person, and there was 30 to 40 severe injuries. This is where people required hospitalizations.
In 2008, Smith studied 175 conflicts where people used deterrents such as pepper spray. He says that study showed bear spray worked 92% of the time compared to a 67% success rate using guns. And he says conflicts involving bear spray were less hazardous for bears and people than those involving guns.
Bear spray resulted in about only, of those people involved, only three humans were injured by bears. It was all by grizzly bears or brown bears, and they were all minor injuries. That is, they didn't require hospitalization.
However, Smith emphasizes he's not anti-gun.
Somebody said, well, I wouldn't put my gun down to use bear spray. And I said, well, I'm with you on that. I wouldn't either. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. If I had a gun in my hands and a bear was charging, I would start shooting and I wouldn't quit until it was down and dead.
He says part of the problem is that few people are actually well prepared to shoot a charging bear.
Nobody I know practices shooting a large object coming at you at incredible speed over uneven terrain in dense brush and can be accurate with that. That's a problem. So that's, I think, part of why we see it. The other one is, let's say you're in camp and you're walking around and you're getting things ready. You're not going to be walking around with a gun in your hand. But if you have a can of bear spray on your hip, at least you've got something that you can bring up to dissuade a bear, to coax it to go somewhere else.
On the other hand, Smith says guns do have one significant advantage.
Guns do something that non-lethal deterrents like bear spray cannot do, which is a gun can settle the argument for once and for all. You can pull the trigger, the bear is dead. And that's the end of that. And sometimes that is the only solution for some bears in Alaska that have either gotten into garbage and they're not going to leave a camp alone, they're going to tear things up, they're starting to threaten survivability of the people involved. That bear needs to be shot. And, going around with bear spray isn't going to really help you.
Smith says the big lesson here is it's best not to ever get charged by a bear. Experts recommend that when in bear country, people hike in groups, avoid areas with poor visibility, give mothers and cubs wide berth, and make lots of noise so as not to surprise a bear. Smith also says bears can run much faster than people, so it's best to stand your ground if a bear does charge. Smith's study was published in the latest issue of the Journal of Wildlife Management. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
A Ketchikan man on Sunday rescued a small black bear cub whose head was stuck in a plastic jar. After multiple attempts, Michael Schuler was able to release the bear cub. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
Schuler had just wrapped up some avalanche tests on Ketchikan's Deer Mountain when he decided to climb up to the summit. Hiking with his friend's dog, Josie, Schuler stumbled across the black bear cub.
What my brain saw was a water bottle with a head of hair, like, leaning on it, So I totally just stopped and had to take a look and couldn't quite place because it was so snow-covered. It was moving, kind of lolling around.
He says the dog started to growl as the two walked around the animal, trying to figure out what it is they were looking at.
It was so snow-covered, and it just didn't, at first it didn't occur to me that it would be a cub, out, especially right on the summit. I've been up a lot on Deer Mountain this winter doing snowpack study stuff, and I've only seen a couple of marten tracks up that high. That's the only thing. Some wolf down low, some goat, stuff like that. So it was really kind of a shock.
Schuller says he racked his brain and decided the only other animal that could be that size would be a wolverine.
I was like, well, we don't have wolverines here. But I was still running it through my head, and I thought, well, if it's a bear cub, I can handle that, you know. But if it's a wolverine, it'll have, as soon as it's out, it's gonna tear me apart, you know. So it took a few minutes, and I poked it with a hiking pole a little bit, and got it to try to, it kind of rolled over, and moved its feet out from underneath it, and then I saw that it was a bear.
Before trying to free the animal, Schuller says he attempted to get in touch with a wildlife biologist to see if there were any protocols for dealing with a trapped bear. After multiple phone calls, including one call with a trooper, Schuller says he tied the dog up and went to work trying to free the bear.
I reached down and I grabbed the jar, and I just thought that as soon as I had the jar in my hands, he'd just pull his head out and back away, and that'd be it. And he tugged back, and nothing happened. And so I let him back up a little bit, and I gave it a good tug toward me, thinking, well, that'll take care of it. And that didn't do anything. So I kind of thought for a second, and I thought, well, I'll just pick him up, right? Pick him up and kind of just shake him out. So I picked the cub up completely off the ground and did a kind of a little drop shake, and that still didn't do anything.
By that time, Schuller says the cub was becoming agitated, making noise and trying to get away.
So I couldn't let go of the jar now at this point. So I had my ice axe, and I was able to stick the point of my ice axe through the plastic at the very bottom and stand on my ice axe for a minute while I sort of sorted out what I was going to do next.
He says he used his ice axe to anchor the jar into the snow. He then sat on the bear and cut the jar open with a work knife. By the time the bear was free, Schuller says Josie the dog had chewed through her lead and was running around barking.
She didn't chase the bear or anything. She just kind of was, you know, saying, let's go. And it spun around. And I think as soon as it saw, you know, spun around away from me, it just took off at a dead run down the hill.
Schuller says he didn't see the bear cub again after that. However, as he was hiking down the mountain, just after the second outlook, he saw fresh bear cub tracks crossing the trail, headed into the trees downhill. Schuller says the bear was quite small, around 7 or 8 pounds. Schuller says he's frustrated that someone left trash on the mountain that could have very well killed the bear cub.
Carry out what you carry in, and sometimes the most, you know, innocuous thing can really turn dangerous.
In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Charlotte Duran in Wrangell, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Ann Hillman reported from the Takotna Checkpoint. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.